Hello and welcome to Images, a public affairs program on KRWG that looks at the art, the flavors, the culture, and the people of New Mexico. Hi, I'm Carrie Hamblin, the host of Images. Thanks for tuning in for an exploration into the hidden treasures of our area. Growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Hazia Diner grew up in a time where the equality movement was beginning to take shape. With a father who is a self-described socialist, Hazia Diner was exposed to understanding the importance of righting the societal wrongs. She remembers watching on television the desegregation of the schools in the South and worked at desegregating her own school in the Milwaukee Public School District. Hazia Diner is our guest today on Images. With a doctorate from the University of Illinois at Chicago, she has published numerous books on the experience of American Jews. She has been the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a senior postdoctoral fellowship at the Shelby Cullum Davis Center for Historical Research. Last month, she was in Las Cruces, speaking at the Arriving in America, the Challenge of Immigrants and Minorities in Modern American History series, sponsored by the History Department in the College of Arts and Sciences at New Mexico State. Hazia Diner remembers as a college student in Madison, Wisconsin, many of her college experiences were about social justice issues in the 60s. She remembers one particular time where some members of the Students for a Democratic Society at Madison interrupted a class challenging Hazia's boundaries.
The SDS invaded the class and ran up onto the platform where the professor was lecturing and said, nobody should be in class, there's a demonstration going on, and he threw them out. And he had actually been a refugee from Nazi Germany. And he just said, I saw this before, this mass hysteria of the crowd, and he said, I saw it in Nazi Germany. And I tried to, it really was hard for me to figure that out, because I agreed with the premises of the SDS kids. But on the other hand, it caused me to wonder, well, what about that behavior? And how does the extreme left and the extreme right engage in the same sorts of tactics, even though they may have done it for different purposes? And it's not that I came to an answer then, and I probably then was more thinking what an old fuddy-duddy he is. I really appreciate it in retrospect that because both sides were being presented, you had to struggle with where you placed yourself.
And did you find that, there were multiple situations where you were in that, kind of in that middle part of trying to figure
out? Absolutely. And I did my master's at the University of Chicago, and an event that really was formative for me is there was a evening program, one of the big national radicals was there, and kind of hero of the left, and he spoke, and then another person who was also SDS got up and said, Brother Mark, so it was Mark Rudd, has to go to Ann Arbor, so we need somebody to pass around a hat for his trade fair. Mm-hmm. And the fact is he was from a very wealthy family who supported him in this, but there was a man standing in the back of this auditorium who was from an usher service, and he was there to make sure nobody smoked, whatever, crowd control. So the speaker said, in fact, why doesn't somebody take the hat off that pig and pass it around? And so these guys go and they rush this man and they knock him down. They're trying to get his hat and he's holding on to his hat, and they keep pushing him down. And so one professor stood up and said, how can you be talking about the inhumanity of the university when you don't respect the humanity of basically a working class individual who's here, this job? And then the people on the stage shouted him down and said, you're nothing but a professor. And it really was, again, a kind of a revelatory moment in terms of the end and the means. And if you want to pursue a political end that you consider to be humane, can you engage in non-humane action to get there? And, what's the line and where is the line? And, and there's no easy answer,
yeah.
Right? So it really was very formative. Again, not that I said A was right and B was wrong, but rather that these situations are morally complex.
Well, it had to be kind of a surreal situation to watch this happen.
Absolutely. I was sitting there and taking this in and saying, by being here, am I sort of condoning this action? But on the other hand, I did think that the student revolt was a very important, and at that point, I didn't realize how transformative it was going to be. But I said, we kind of have to do this, and do the ends justify the means? Right. And it was like, I felt like I was living through history, and as opposed to reading about it.
Now, is this something that when in becoming very active in political movements, is that something that was encouraged in your family life?
Yes. So when I was in high school, I was actually involved in the civil rights movement in Milwaukee. And it was, again, very important to me and my parents. My father in particular were completely supportive of this. And I was involved with, we formed a group called Youth for Integration, and high school students, black and white high school students. In fact, it was Jewish and black high school students. I can't even remember exactly what we did, but we did form this organization, and it was certainly my first exposure. I never had any contact with African Americans before. We lived in a very, completely white neighborhood, and the schools were obviously segregated, not by law, but by neighborhood. And yet I was, I think, in elementary school watching the TV news about, for example, the desegregation in Little Rock, asking my father about this and said, what does this mean and why are they doing that? And, his answer was, this is a really evil system and it has to end, and it's the responsibility of the government to treat all citizens equally. And then I got involved in this, on a high school level. When I was a senior in high school, I was president, obviously which is not a very lofty position, of Future Teachers of America. And so I invited as a speaker the leader of the civil rights struggle in Milwaukee, a man by the name of Lloyd Barbee, who is the president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who was at that point, his issue was the desegregation of the Milwaukee schools and was organizing a school boycott. And so I invited him to come and speak to FTA, and the principal went nuts, and he calls me in. He said, "Who gave you permission to invite him?" And I said, "Well, we invited other speakers, and nobody ever asked for permission." And he was, just kind of fulminating against this. And finally, he said, "When he comes, he has to see me first." And I consider that such a triumph. And Lloyd Barbee spoke. I don't know how the other students reacted. And then there was a boycott of Milwaukee Public Schools. And the principal actually sent me a note as saying, "If you participate, you're going to be suspended for a day." And my father said, "That's okay." This is really important to, make the society better.
Well, with your parents being so supportive in terms of your activism about, social justice issues, what was it about your parents that that really kind of provided that for you? Can you tell me about your folks?
Well, my father always defined himself as a socialist, and he had come from Russia. My parents were both immigrants, and my father, though, was very active. I mean, he politically always talked about himself as a socialist. And I remember in high school, he gave me to read Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards, this kind of utopian novel of a socialist society. They were not only socialists, or he really not so much my mother, but, very active supporters of trade unions. One time, one of the bakeries, the kosher bakery, was not there. The workers were on strike. It was on Center Street. And my mother anyhow bought a loaf of bread there. My father told my sister and me, "Don't eat that. We don't eat, anything where it's bought in a store," which was being picketed. And she was really upset by that. But, so there was this really moral skin. I think he was totally shaped by the condition of Jews in Russia, and thinking about the Holocaust and the way in which class inequity went hand in hand with racial inequity, and that people, when they see something wrong, can't just sit back and say, oh, well, it's not my problem, mm-hmm. or, oh, well, it just has to be, but rather if people have to stand up and say, I'm going to do whatever in my very limited way. And for him, with this bakery, it was just not eating, not shopping there. It was voting all the time for progressive candidates. And he had a very active member of the Labor Zionist Organization of America. So these were socialist Zionists working for the advancement of Israel as a social, it was then a socialist country, mm-hmm. and so supporting the Labor Party. So this was just sort of the constant talk. And I think he was an older parent, and so he grew up in Tsarist Russia. So in a way, he knew a society that was utterly autocratic and when nobody had rights. And he talked about seeing peasants being beaten, and obviously he came from Ukraine. So he lived through several pogroms, these bloody riots against mm-hmm. Jews. And he had seen it all. Talk about living through history.
Right.
And then he was already in the United States by the time of the Holocaust, but feeling this paralysis, like there's nothing we can do, right. Which was absolutely the case. There was nothing they could do. And so I think this really imbued me with a sense that kind of a clear idea of what's just and what's unjust. Mm-hmm. And unjust is when people are treated differently because of who they are, and it is the responsibility of the state, it's the responsibility, to make things better, and the responsibility of individuals to act in support of justice.
Well, it sounds like your father was a very big man in terms of his conviction.
Very much so.
And what about your mom?
She was a little more complicated. She was actually a Holocaust survivor.
Okay.
And I would say for her, what was really important was survival.
Yeah.
And to the point on a personal level of often walking through the alley so she could look in people's garbage cans, to find shoes. Or she once found some eyeglasses. And taking them, and I would say, what are these? And obviously you can't wear somebody else's glasses, and it was basically, you never know if you can sell them on the black market, right. Or so it was all about survival. And therefore, if the bread in the bakery cost less when the workers were on strike. You buy it anyhow. But she, too, spoke very eloquently about racial injustice in the United States and how horrendous, watch. It wasn't in our personal lives because we lived this, again, very white neighborhood. But it was watching the news and the demonstrations, demonstrators in Birmingham being hosed down by, the police and with dogs set on them. And so for her, I think this was really bringing back some of this imagery. With her, one of the moments I remember very well was when the March on Washington, the day of the March on Washington, and it was on TV, and we had a television on all day watching it, and she was angry, and her anger was, and in a sense, historically, what she said was, nobody marched for us. And now the fact is, she's wrong. She was wrong only in the sense that it was a different historic moment.
Right.
In the 30s and 40s. But be that as it may, her reaction was, nobody marched for us. And it was almost like, I can't now watch people marching for someone else. Which I couldn't accept as a rationale. And I would almost, I don't think I said it at the time, but now I could, say it, is, well, if nobody marched for you, that's all the more reason to march for someone else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like, you had such very strong and passionate figures as parents in your life. And I'm wondering, with this, conveying the importance of your family history, because, I mean, you became a historian.
Right.
So where did that start?
Well, I always loved history. And I'd say that when I was a kid, I became an addicted reader. And the first set of books that I remember absolutely being intrigued by and sort of kind of almost inhaling them were these biographies of famous Americans with silhouette pictures. I don't remember who the publisher was, but I just loved them. And even if the biography was about a sports character, Lou Gehrig or Babe Ruth, I knew nothing about sports, I still loved reading them. And the way in which their lives were sort of shaped by history and how they shaped history and so on. And then I graduated to the Landmark series. So I just loved history. I loved politics. And I remember as an adolescent meeting, shaking hands with John Kennedy when he was campaigning in 1960 in Milwaukee. And the sense, like, I really want to know what happened and how did it happen and so on. So I think when I entered college, I had no doubt I was going to be a history major.
Well, when you began your studies, what brought you to focus on the areas that you did?
Right. So first graduate seminar I took was called Race and Ethnicity in American History. Okay, and it was partly that was one of the ones that was being offered in U.S. history. So U.S. history. And I'd probably say I went into U.S. history, I think because I was a child of immigrants, to me, America was in a way kind of foreign and fascinating because there were many things that went on in the larger society that my parents knew nothing about. And we, my sister and I, were like their translators of America. And I remember when we told them about Thanksgiving and, you know, like, hey, couldn't we have that too? So in a way, America was, despite having been born here, a foreign country. And so I think that's what intrigued me about it. And so in this seminar on race and ethnicity, the professor said on that first class, talking about the paper you had to write, the research paper, if you know an immigrant language, you could consider writing a seminar paper using sources in that language. And then 5 minutes later, it dawned to me, I know an immigrant language. I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking home. I can read it as though I'm reading English. Let me try that. And it really just opened up to me what would seem like a very rich way to not only study American Jewish history or Jewish history, but actually a way to study American history.
Because they do.
Yeah. And so, for example, the paper I wrote for him, which became the basis of my first book, was on, and this is not going to be shocking after everything I told you about my high school civil rights, youth for integration. I wrote a paper on the way in which Jews as new immigrants to the United States in the early 20th century made sense of, through like the Yiddish press, race relations in America. So how did they write about the race riots? How did they write about segregation? And in Yiddish, for immigrant readers. So the newspapers were very important because they were conveying to the new immigrants lots of information about this new country in which they were living.
And probably from a perspective that they weren't seeing in mainstream press.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so, in early 20th century, let's say particularly in 1919, where there were hundreds of race riots all over the United States, Washington, D.C., Chicago, so on. And so they're covered in the Yiddish press. But the Yiddish press, when it wrote about these race riots, wrote about them in the same language that they used to describe these pogroms or these attacks on Jews in Europe. So they would call bloody pogrom in East St. Louis against Negroes. And so that they used the terminology of their own experience and the people who were perpetrating the race riots against the whites who were perpetrating the race riots against African-Americans in Chicago or Washington were called Cossacks. Okay. So Spain in the late Middle Ages, the Jews were very much persecuted and Jews would be brought brought to something called, it was called the auto-da-fé, or it was the place where one would have to, these were very complicated, I guess maybe it's not so complicated, Jews who converted to Catholicism, okay. But were really Jews, but pretending, were often arrested and brought to this, to the Inquisition, and they had to confess their faith. So The auto-da-fé was the place with it. And so when African-Americans were lynched, again, very common in the early decades of the 20th century, in these Yiddish new articles, they would say, so-and-so, James Smith, a Negro from Helena, Arkansas, was brought to the auto-da-fé and hanged from a tree. So it was like, they identified so intensely with the crisis or the plight of African Americans that they elided their experience.
It really kind of blended.
So you would have never seen that in an American newspaper. A race riot in East St. Louis was front page in the Yiddish paper, like page 25 in English in the New York Times.
Right.
So anyhow, so that's how I got into it, was through that route, and that seemed to me a great way to study American history.
Our guest today on Images is Hashia Diener. Now I'm going to do that again. Andrea Orsoff. Our guest today on Images is Hashia Diener, the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University. Well, this project that prompted you to start exploring your history in this, I'm wondering, when you talk about Jews being in the United States in the early 20th century, several of the participants in the series that brings you here have talked about Irish immigrants in American history and African Americans in American history. So how far back do Jews go in the United States?
Okay, well, Jews go back in the United States in small number, actually, to long before it was the United States. So the first Jews actually come to New Amsterdam in the 17th century, 1654. Since we're here in the Southwest, I'll say that there were actually Jews in the Southwest even before that, because there were Jews who had converted to Catholicism. Again, for some of them, it was a kind of fraud. I mean, that is, they were Jews, but lived publicly as Catholics, but in private, either understood that they had Jewish ancestry or were Jews, maintained some practices. Some of them really were, were in fact sincerely Catholic, but we understand them in some ways to still have the legacy of their parents' or grandparents' Judaism. So many of them actually come to the Southwest with the Spanish armies, and there are parts of New Mexico where scholars have found traces of these early conversos, these conversos who are among the early Europeans who settle who settled, and in some cases they would just have strange family practices which harkened back to kind of Jewish roots.
Is this along the lines of the Ladino Jews?
That's a little different.
Okay.
But in the main, the Jews, the European Jews, or the Jews come to the United States first in the 17th century, living along the Atlantic seaboard. In the 1820s, a mass migration of Jews begins from places like Bavaria and other German-speaking regions, coming to the Eastern Seaboard, but then fanning out all over the country, many of them as peddlers, and then they become small shopkeepers. Pretty much wherever there's the need for goods, serving small town populations. And again, some of the early Jews who come to New Mexico are Jews from Poland, and coming in the 1860s and 1870s, they come as they open shops. They settle. They go out and sell to the farmers and ranch owners in the area. They sometimes will have contracts with the U.S. military. They sell them horses. So from the 1820s through about the 1870s, about a quarter of a million Jews came to the United States, but they're primarily coming from Central Europe. While New York is the largest community, they do spread all over. They end up in Alaska. There's like almost no place where they're not, in small towns, medium-sized towns, and so on. But the huge wave of 3 million Jews begins in the 1870s and goes until the middle of the 1920s. And these are the Jews of what we call Eastern Europe. That is what now, if we looked at a map of the world, and obviously these borders kept changing, but what now would be Poland, Romania, Hungary, Lithuania, Ukraine, Russia, Belarus. And these places all had different names at the time. So, for example, the Jews who come from what's now Poland were coming from a region of the Austro-Hungarian Empire called Galicia. So that's why it's really hard to know if we should call them what those places are now or what they were called then, because if you use the words of what they were called then, nobody will know what you're talking about. This is the mass Jewish migration. Well over 90% of American Jews owe their ancestry to that migration. There was a small Jewish migration also from parts of the Ottoman Empire, again from Greece and Turkey, Syria. So there are these smaller migrations. A small but very important Jewish influx begins in the face of the rise of Nazism from Germany, Austria, Czechoslovakia. So from the mid-30s until 38, 39. And then with the war, migration ends. And then after World War II, about 100,000, 150,000 Holocaust survivors came to the United States as Congress passed the Displaced Persons Act in 1948 and 52. That's basically the peopling of American Jewry. There are some post-1965 immigrants, but the numbers really, the real kind of core of the population is in that 1870-1920s migration.
And so why did this population fan out, I mean, and go, you know, to the far reaches of the continent?
The fanning out is primarily a product of that 1820-1870 migration. So there, they were kind of real pioneers, you know, going to Ohio and Pennsylvania and Kansas and so on, basically in search of trade. Because these become they begin as the peddlers, and being a peddler means, you know, you hear that there's a real good opportunity to peddle in the Mesabi Iron Range of northern Minnesota. So, you go there, and once you go there, then your brother's going to go there when he comes, and your cousin, and so on. The later group, the 1870 through 1920, is very heavily based for New York. By the turn of the 20th century, so about 1900, over 70% of all American Jews live in New York City. Those who are going elsewhere tend to go to big cities, Chicago, Baltimore, Cleveland, and they go because that's where they go for industrial jobs. They're not going into shopkeeping, and most of them go for actually a single job or a single kind of industry, which was garment making. So wherever there were clothing factories, you saw Jews, and this grew out of the fact that I think it was a skill they had. They had been making garments for a long time. That was the Jewish craft. And the earlier Jewish immigrants also established garment factories or garment shops. And so Jews tended to work for other Jews. And garment making really was a kind of self-perpetuating Jewish industry. So that where those industries were located, Jews went. And because Jews went there, the industry grew.
Well, in previous with Matthew Jacobson and Spencer Crew, we talked about how these particular groups were treated by, you know, the framers of the country. And I'm wondering how or those who settled after, how were Jewish immigrants treated? Because it is a different group altogether that...
Okay, so again, I'm going to. I hope you don't mind if I give you a slightly longer answer. So there's certain ways in which Jews come to the United States utterly privileged. Okay, and they come to the country privileged in as much as they for two things. First, they're defined as white. Okay, and the fact that they're white means that they have the basic bundle of rights that go with citizenship. So kind of ipso facto, they end up, they begin on the privileged side of the equation. The other are some of the basic, you refer to the framers. So the fact is there's no linkage in the Constitution between religion and citizenship. And this for them is an absolutely new experience.
We'll hear more of that interview with Hajah Diner on next week's program. Hajah Diner is the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University and the director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History. She's the author of several books, including her most recent, We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, available from NYU Press. If you'd like to hear this program again or others, you can find them all on our website, krwg.org. Find the radio button on the menu bar, and in the drop-down menu, you will see images. Click on that, and you'll find this program and others there for you to listen to on your computer or as a podcast. I'm Carrie Hamblin. Thanks for tuning in tonight. I hope you've enjoyed the program and that you'll tune in again next week at 5:30 for another Images, right before Purim Companion on 90.7 KRWG Las Cruces.